Chariot TechCast Episode 69, our first 2012 Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise speaker interview. This one with Alex Hillman, co-founder of the co-working cooperative Independence Hall. The Chariot TechCast is provided by Chariot Solutions. Practical, smart software development, mentoring, and training in a wide variety of open source and leading edge technologies in web, mobile, and software integration. Visit us online at chariotsolutions.com. And by Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise, Chariot's conference that brings together leading open source contributors with the Mid-Atlantic technology community. It's rapidly approaching. See speakers such as keynote Chad Fowler, VP of Engineering at Living Social, keynote Alex Payne, CTO of Simple Finance. They discuss topics such as self-engineering and emerging programming languages. Also see talks by JavaScript legend Douglas Crockford, author of JavaScript The Good Parts, Adrian Holovaty, the co-creator of the Python Django web framework, SpringSource's Josh Long, Jeff Brown, and Chris Richardson, who discuss Spring Batch, Grails 2.0, and NoSQL as well, Scala, Responsive Web Design, Comcast Interactive Media's Sean Brown, and so many others. Register before February 14th and catch the Early Bird Special. Even at the non-early bird price, it's really gearing up to be a special event. Register online at phillyemergingtech.com. My guest today is Alex Hillman. He is a leader in the co-working movement who helped to found Independence Hall, known by the shortened name Indy Hall. We discuss how Alex got into technology entrepreneurship, his technical background, some of his projects, and we also discuss his talk, Enterprise Makeover, Turning Cost Centers into Profit Centers. Alex Hillman, welcome to the Chariot TechCast.
Thanks for having me.
So now let's talk a little bit about your background. You're known very well in the Philadelphia area as being kind of a tech entrepreneur person, or at least someone who through Indy Hall has done a lot of putting companies together and getting companies started. Let's talk a little bit about your background.
Sure. So the sort of history of Indy Hall came from the fact that near the end of 2006, I was actually looking to leave my full-time job. I had been freelancing. So I was a web developer working for a couple of the local agencies here, the interactive agencies. And I had started freelancing. And as I was building my freelance portfolio and sort of the brand around that, one of the things I encountered is that it was easier for me to find potential collaborators in other cities than it was to find potential collaborators in my own city. And that was a problem for me. It was a problem so much that I considered leaving Philadelphia and instead decided to take one last good hard look and see if there was anybody here that I just hadn't found yet. And that good hard look ultimately turned into Indy Hall. I not only found people that were doing cool, interesting, creative things online, but I also found that a lot of them were also looking for other people. And so it became sort of this course of sort of exploring Philadelphia's tech community together. And that turned into the original core community that was Indy Hall before Indy Hall was an office. And then about a year later, we opened up our first, the clubhouse. We built that club. So Indy Hall became the clubhouse for the club. And we've been growing ever since.
Fantastic. Now, one of the things you're kind of espousing is this concept of co-working.
Right.
I guess Indy Hall is kind of the case study or your push for what co-working is and how it works.
Sure. So I learned about this idea of co-working. It was happening in San Francisco, one of the places where I was easily finding collaborators, from some folks that were pretty prominent in the open source community. And what they had done with things like co-working and Barcamp was take open source sort of methodology and apply it to non-software things. So in cases of co-working and Barcamp, there were these sort of loose ideas around how we would gather and get something done, but they valued contribution and participation at sort of the highest level. There's that, and then there's a sort of meta level of open source where we took those ideas for events and workspaces and communities and shared the way that we built them, much like you would share the source to an open source project, and said, you can go and build your own. All that we ask is if you do a good job and you learn something and you sort of iterate on it, you contribute that back. And sort of this global community of people running co-working spaces has been built over the last 5 years or so, 6 years or so, on top of people sharing these, you know, ideas around different ways to work, different ways to get work done. And it really comes down to, sort of this hybrid between a community center and a workspace, where people come here to get work done. But a lot of times they're coming here to be around other people, specifically these other people. I guess the idea is that, you know, the secret to a better work environment isn't the office, it's better coworkers.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so when you're, you know, going and working in Indy Hall and you're trying to put together a company or you're trying to put together some technology, what are some of the models you've seen people collaborate with? I mean, it's probably anything, but
yeah. So I think that, I mean, the important consistent element is the way people get together. When you're working together in a normal company or even a normal networking environment, everybody's out to get what they need from somebody else all the time. Just think about the last networking environment you went to. It was a happy hour or whatever, and you're talking to somebody and you can sort of tell that they're trying to figure out what you do so they can ask a favor. And maybe not now, but down the road. And it becomes a sort of really uncomfortable environment, and it's not how people really interact with each other outside of the business world. And so sort of our philosophy in terms of collaboration comes from the foundation for collaboration is trust. If you don't have trust, you don't really have collaboration. You're just getting work done. And in order to collaborate, in order to get trust, there needs to be environments where trust can be built. And so the idea here is that it's a little bit more of a European or Asian philosophy around business is that, you know, if you do a business deal, a big business deal in Asia, there's usually, you know, weeks, if not months of sort of courting where you go into, you know, dinners and drinks and, you know, a lot of American businesses would view that as a big waste of time. But in Asia, it's critical because if you sort of fail the social test, we're not doing business with you no matter how good the terms are. And so sort of a lot of indie haulers sort of operate in the same philosophy is we need to get along. And if we get along, it almost doesn't matter what we're working on because we'll find a way to make it work. And so indie haul really puts a lot of its emphasis on finding ways to help people build relationships, both professional and personal, and really ends up being, you know, an office full of people who genuinely like to be around each other, which, you know, it's that's a pretty rare thing to walk into an office where everybody really, really digs each other. And that has to happen here because in this office, unlike most others, these people don't have to be here. They're here by choice. In fact, they're paying to leave their home offices where they could get work done, come here and get work done around other people because they know that it makes them more productive. They know that it makes them happier. And so our offering needs to be unique and really, really help them get more work done. And from everything everybody tells us, and I can speak personally because it's done this for me, it works.
And you're talking mostly, probably almost completely, freelancers, essentially, correct?
Not necessarily.
Or is that a bad term for it?
Well, I mean, that's not necessarily a bad term, but, you know, freelancers, I would say the easier way to classify it is anyone who can work from anywhere. We do have freelancers. We do have entrepreneurs. We have people who run small businesses. We have people who work remote for other companies. Remote workers is a big part of this because, you know, if you work from home for a company, you've sort of avoided having the boss breathing down your neck, but you miss out on the coworkers and the interactions. So again, this goes back to the better coworkers. You know, if you work remote, then working from a co-working space can help you get back some of those coworker interactions. They just might not be the coworkers at the company you work for.
Right. So I'm assuming maybe there's some open source contributors there. People working on, you know, various Apache type projects or what have you.
I mean, the stuff people work on here, I mean, so obviously this is a tech podcast, so we can talk about tech. I think one of the interesting things about Indy Hall is it's also a fairly rare environment where while there's lots of technology people here, there's lots of non-technology people here too. People use technology every day in their business, but they may not consider themselves, you know, technology practitioners, or they don't think that technology is how they make money. For them, a laptop or a piece of software is a tool just as much as a hammer is to a carpenter. But when those people get to sit next to each other, the ideas that they can share and the collaborations that come out of that are really pretty amazing. And I think that the point is that we learn when we're learning from our coworkers, we learn a lot more from people that are less like us. So having an environment where people can sort of bump into each other that normally wouldn't have a chance to is pretty awesome. We have, you know, we have scientists and we have people that are writers and we have people that are in nonprofits and in film and music, all working around people that are doing technology and web design and business and things like that. And when all those people sort of, you know, mix together, there's You know, there's the story that if you put an engineer, a scientist, and an artist, and a business person in a room together, something really interesting is going to happen. Indie Hall is that just multiplied times at least 100, if not more.
That's fantastic. I mean, normally you're right. In a technologist perspective, you're generally in a group of technologists working on a project. You might have one business person available to you, unless you're doing, you know, like agile or what have you. And then you hopefully have more involvement, but it's not quite the same as what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think if I had to look for a common thread, there's a couple of things regardless of what industry people are working in. One of them is people are really passionate about what they work on. They really genuinely care. So sort of like the craftsman, you know, I know there's been a lot of talk about
like software craftsmanship. Yeah.
Software. Yeah, exactly. So imagine that, but for everything else, people here genuinely care about the work that they're putting into it.
What kinds of projects have come out of Indie Hall?
Yeah. So, again, it's been across the spectrum. We can talk about some of the software that's come out. There was a product that was sort of co-developed among some Indie Hall members. It was a DVD ripper. The legal implications aside, it became the dominant DVD ripper in the market. It took over the place of the previous, of leading piece of software. And that was developed by a guy who came to Indie Hall, and he developed it out in the open. And then he said, are there any designers around? And a designer raised his hand and he goes, cool, I need, an icon designed. And then he goes, okay, I need an e-commerce platform to sell this. Does anybody, have any experience in e-commerce? And they worked together and they built a new licensing platform, an e-commerce platform for this tool. So the product was called Rip It. It's since been sold to a company in Australia and it continues to do very well, but it was born here at Indie Hall in Philadelphia. There's another cool story about a company that's now based out of Brooklyn called Orpheus Media Research. And Orpheus Media Research came to Indie Hall as one guy who he was actually not a technologist. He was a PhD musician. And Greg was using his deep understanding of music to sort of figure out why he was really good at musical improvisation. And he figured out sort of the algorithms that was using creatively to create music. And he said, well, if I can teach a person how to improv, why can't I teach a computer how to improv? And so he set out into building software that would analyze music in a way that had never been done before. Fast forward a ways, and he ended up collaborating with people both on the technology and the business side of this company, developing a product, taking it to market, and is now working. It's sort of changed shape a couple of times, but the core algorithms are the same in the fact that he's basically built a music search tool that's different from something like Pandora. So when you're searching for music with music using Pandora, it's reliant on human metadata. So there's a room full of music nerds that listen to music all day long and apply tags to it. And so when you say, Pandora, I want to hear more songs like this song, it's not actually listening to the song, it's referring to the metadata. Greg's software actually listens to the music. It breaks it apart and listens to it with software that's modeled after the way the human brain listens to music. And then assigns a bunch of pieces of non-human readable metadata to that music and stores it in a database. Now, when I want to search for music, I can actually load in a clip of music with no metadata associated with it. It could be a untitled.mp3 with no ID3 tags, and it may not know what that music is, but it'll find other music like it. It's remarkable.
Incredible.
It's incredible. And that was this is a non-technical person coming to Indie Hall, teaching themselves enough technology to build a prototype, but then joining forces with a collaborator here at Indie Hall and making it something that was actually productizable and can take it to market.
This is a movement. It's not just one environment. This is like, as you said, kind of a maybe worldwide, probably is the term, movement of people coming together and doing these things. And you have a whole wiki around this, right?
Yeah, we do. There's coworking.com, which can point you to a wiki, a Google group, and a blog. The Google group is probably the most actively updated and easiest to follow along. The wiki, as most wikis tend to, becomes difficult to garden.
Right.
But you can still find tons and tons and tons of ideas and information and sharing about what's going on around the world. I also, you know, I travel around. I meet with people. Actually, just, 15 minutes ago, 20 minutes ago before we got on this call, was meeting with someone here in Philadelphia who wants to open up something like Indie Hall, but more for media producers. So people that are doing video and audio and things like that. So we're really open and sharing just about everything that we can. I've traveled around all over the States and Europe, speaking on the topic and sharing what we've learned in terms of some of the bigger patterns. And I also teach workshops and classes to help people that are new catalysts or founders to communities and spaces like this, to help them get off on the right foot. So I invest a good amount of time. People shared so much with me and gave me the foundation to make this possible, and then we've put in a bunch of our own work to make it even better. So being a good open source contributor, I go out of my way to share share our lessons, both what works and what doesn't.
Okay. And then in your time that you're not doing this, what are some of the projects you're working on? Again, you were originally a web designer and web developer rather.
Yeah.
And you're still involved in companies that do web applications, right?
Sure, sure. So yeah, my focus, sort of stays in technology because it's a tool set that I know I'm really familiar with and I really enjoy it. So that's great. But I've sort of gotten more involved in companies that let me work with technology, applying some of these other lessons around, marketing, communication, business growth, team building, and things like that. So the last couple of years have been interesting. I've gotten out of doing the web development myself, and I've worn a bunch of different hats. I spent time as the interactive director for a world-class advertising agency. I was the director of technology for an e-commerce company. And now I'm I don't really have a title at this company. We all wear a lot of different hats, but there's a company called WildBit here in Philadelphia that does a couple of software products that are geared towards developers. And I do something that's a hybrid between communications and marketing and business development and community management. I spend a lot of time working with our customers and our partners to find out what we could be doing more of, what we're doing that's working, and then folding that into communication, folding it into our marketing strategy, looking for partnerships, forging those relationships. And really, my ultimate bid is to help the business grow.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you're working on there is Beanstalk.
Yes, that's right.
So talk to me a little bit about that.
Sure. So Beanstalk is a hosted version control, collaboration, and deployment platform. So the idea behind Beanstalk is that hosting version control, or rather, I should say, the idea behind Beanstalk is that using version control shouldn't require a PhD in version control.
yes.
There's a lot of people that know they should be using some sort of version control, but they're afraid of it. It's intimidating. It's kind of scary. And so the main purpose of Beanstalk is to lower that barrier to entry. So at its core, it's code hosting. So we host your repositories, Subversion, Git, and very soon Mercurial. If anybody's interested in an invite to our Mercurial beta, you can drop me an email and I'd love to get you in on that. And so that gives you access to very easily create and manage the permissions on repositories, as well as create and manage permissions on the user side of things as well. So you don't have to go in and do any complicated scripting or configuration files. It's all visual. It's all very pretty and easy to use. Then there's the sort of collaboration side of things, where we have tools for making it easy for you to do code review. We have we've got email notifications, and we have the ability to you get an email notification about a commit change set. You reply to that, and those comments go back into the application and they get emailed out to the other people that care about it.
Nice.
We also do integrations with things like time trackers and issue trackers. So every single commit you make, you can log time, or you can log the bug ticket that's associated, and Beanstalk will tie everything together. So it's really a tool for the entire team, not just the coders. And then the third part of Beanstalk is a deployment engine that actually we just released a brand new version of today. We've been working on for the last almost 9 months. And our deployment engine sort of is taking a crack at this whole world of DevOps. I don't know how much you know about that.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so we're really excited about the idea of putting sort of these ops tools in the hands of even the novice web developer. You shouldn't need to learn Capistrano to be able to deploy your code from source control. So that's what we built. And so we've got these beautiful user interfaces around configuring your deployment environments, and your environment can contain one or many servers. And what we'll do, either with the one click of a button or even from a tag inside of a commit, we'll figure out what environment you want to deploy to, whether it's staging or production or maybe you've got a shared development environment, whatever it may be, we'll look at all the changes since the last deployment that were made, bundle up those files, and then sling them somewhere over FTP or SFTP. The newest version of this actually lets you do the same thing, but over an SSH command. So you can do more complex operations. You can basically write a script on your server that'll maybe do an SVN up or a git pull, run some, you know, copy files, restart web servers, blow away caches, whatever you need. Anything you could do from a terminal, you'll be able to do, you basically preload all those configurations, and we will do it all for you the exact same way every single time with the click of a button.
Is this, is there a particular platform you see people using, friendliness to are a lot of Rails developers using this, or, you know, API wise, I see you have a Ruby API to get into some of this stuff too.
Well, we have a REST API, that we have a Ruby wrapper, and we actually have some community contributions with other languages as well. The Rails community, the PHP is a big one. We have .NET developers. Honestly, it's across the board. Our Beanstalk is the largest Subversion host that's private for teams. So while Git has made, you know, major waves in the world, the majority of our new signups are still Subversion, because there's way more people that aren't using any version control than have already chosen something. And as much of a pain in the neck as Subversion can be, it's much easier to learn.
Yeah, the conceptual, you know, light jump between Subversion and Git is a big one.
Yeah, exactly. So, we focus on making sure that our documentation and our guides, it's guides.beanstalkapp.com. And we wanted to basically, in talking to some, you know, maybe front end developers, or, you know, not necessarily application developers, but people who are going to be less comfortable with man pages, about why they're not using version control, instead of saying it's too hard to use, one of the common things they say is it's too hard to learn. And I thought that was really interesting. And so our team dug in a little bit more, and we realized that it wasn't that it was hard to learn. It was that the documentation was really hard to look at, and it was really hard to read. And so we decided, well, what if we built documentation around version control concepts that were, you know, formatted really well, and they were written really well, and they had big screenshots and things like that. And people love it. People absolutely love it. So, it was a lesson for us in really getting to know who our customer was. And it was people who cared a lot about the way things look. And we have a big, big contingent of designers that use Beanstalk. And getting designers to use version control means that they're going to interact better with programmers that need to use version control. And it's one of those things where once you start using it, you're like, how did I ever work without this?
Right.
And so Beanstalk just lowers that barrier to entry for everyone, honestly. It's interesting. We actually have there's an interesting percentage of writers that, you know, they do their writing in some text editor. A lot of them use Markdown to do formatting, and they use Beanstalk for doing their doing their change tracking. And then they have their editors go in, or their collaborators go in, and use the ability to comment not just on a change set, but on a very specific line of a document, is really pretty helpful for them. So writers like it too.
Interesting. Okay, so let's see here. Let's talk a little bit about what you're going to be doing at Philly Emerging Tech.
Sure. So I mentioned that I spent some time as the CTO of an e-commerce company, and this is a really interesting project to have gotten a chance to work on. So I spent time working with this company as sort of like a hybrid technology marketing person, where they had the company has actually been around for 40 years. And when you go to the Jersey Shore or anywhere where they have those places where you can pick an iron-on transfer off the wall and they'll heat press it onto a t-shirt for you.
Yeah.
Those guys all buy from us.
Wow.
So these guys have been around selling equipment to t-shirt makers for 40 years. And in the early 90s, so talking like 94, 95, they made an early jump into e-commerce. It's like crazy early e-commerce. And they worked with a company at the time that helped them build out their e-commerce platform. And there weren't a lot of them. And one of their constraints was they had this warehouse management software that they had been using forever that did all of their inventory management, customer management, order management, and all of those things. It was already integrated. It worked. So they wanted an e-commerce platform that integrated with that. And at the time, this company they were working with was the only show in town that did that. Fast forward 15 years, and they're still running this company successfully on this e-commerce platform. It had been rewritten a number of times, but it was still this third party outsourced e-commerce platform. So it was outsourced. It was also closed source. It was all .NET. It was all on Windows servers, SQL server. And so there was all the costs that were associated with that were not only there, but they were being passed through at least one layer of markup because this was going through a third party. So in looking at what we wanted to do to grow the company from a marketing perspective, we kept running into barriers in the fact that we had this third party company and their own obligations to their customer base on the software that they built that made it challenging for us to implement growth opportunities on the software side of things. And so if we wanted to grow the company, the software was the limitation, and that was a problem. And so I actually said to the CEO of the company and his father, who he works with, who is the founder of the company, look, guys, I think that you really need to consider taking ownership of your software again, bring it in-house. I have some recommendations on how that process should look. And then we can start going at these market growth opportunities again. And you know, this was new to them. They'd never had an in-house technology team before. And so while I recommended they hire a CTO, they turned around and recommended that they hire me. So I accidentally created a job for myself.
Right.
And it absolutely, you know, the reason I took it was because the project was interesting to me and I really enjoyed working with this father-son that runs the company. And so we ended up taking the company and replatforming the entire thing using open source technology. We're now running on Magento. We've built an entire ground up middleware platform that connects that same warehouse software that had locked them in 15 years before. We figured out a way to get data out of it. We figured out a way to do migrations. We built, we used Python and Django to build custom middleware that interacted with the Magento API. And we built our own infrastructure using Amazon Web Services. So the entire company is running on AWS as well. And so sort of leveraging more modern technologies, open source, cloud hosting, and things like that, not only were we able to replatform this entire company, and honestly, it was less than 9 months. It was close to 7 months, which was extremely aggressive, but I couldn't have been done without these tools being at our disposal. Not only did we do it, but we were able to remove these centers of cost and reduce the cost. So we brought the costs down by like 90% on our annual hosting and software licensing fees. 90% reduction, which is insane how much money they're saving. But the deal was, that's not savings, that's money to put into other opportunities for growth.
Right.
And so we had a strategy for that as well. And so we were able to take that money, start developing an in-house team while we also still work with some freelancers to supplement that. And really, I think that transition from technology being a thing that costs you money, like your rent, to a tool that you've built for yourself, you own, you can repurpose, and you can do more things with, and in the best of cases, do more things that are going to generate more revenue. You've now transformed your cost center into a revenue stream, or many potential revenue streams, which is a thing that I don't think a lot of enterprises really get a chance to do. They're too busy renting to solve a problem today instead of buying to think about the opportunities they could have tomorrow.
Right.
And so that's sort of the center of the talk, sort of what kind of challenges come up in those kind of conversations, both on the technology side as well as the executive side. You know, how hard is it to make those kind of decisions as a business person that's used to thinking a certain way? And then I also have some specific examples of things that we've been able to do in the last year since we relaunched the company, which includes an entire new company. We were able to actually spin off an entire brand new company that provides one of the key resources that we have internally to our websites, which is t-shirt printing and fulfillment. Mm-hmm. So basically, in our warehouse, we print and fulfill t-shirts for our e-commerce website that sells t-shirts. But the problem there is we're limited by the number of t-shirts that our e-commerce platform sells. What if we use the APIs that our website uses to speak to our warehouse and made them into a product and sold them to other people? That was never a possibility before, and now it is. And now we think it's a huge possibility to do something that in the t-shirt world, in the e-commerce world, is not being done yet.
So you could basically be a provider, kind of like a B2B kind of setup for other companies to use to print with excess capacity.
Exactly. So I mean,
the
X for Y, you know, pitch is, this is Twilio for t-shirts. It's a REST API that lets you create digital product t-shirts, treat them as digital products until the last minute, and then produce them and distribute them just in time.
And all this from, you know, you hear things like this and you think startup, right? And it is, I guess it's you're basically building a startup out of a company,
right?
But with people from the company who have the know-how, right?
Yeah. We're building on top of a 40-year-old company that has, you know, four decades of knowledge, experience in everything from the printing and fulfillment, but also customer service. They've also have an established supply chain. That's a tricky one. I had no experience in dealing with technology when the technology needs to leave the technology and interact with things in the real world.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's like developers that have never worked with physical inventory don't know how easy they have it. It's really, really hard to deal with inventory, especially when you need to do inventory real time or close to it. People that like build technology for Amazon have to be some of the most brilliant engineers in the world because it is hard, very, very hard problem. So
I'm sure it's like all sorts of factors, like, you know, keeping accounts up to date. What if a supplier is late? You know, that kind of thing. Keeping like, on track of lost inventory. I mean, there's got to be tons of stuff.
Like returns are the weirdest workflow in the world because they screw up everything.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the fact is we solved all those problems once. So why not build new businesses on top of those solved problems?
Yeah. Very cool. That sounds like a very interesting talk.
So I'm excited. Honestly, you know, it's a project that I did kind of quietly. It was a very different kind of work for me, and it required a lot of concentration and focus. And I was able to use sort of the team building strategies that I have from Indie Hall in order to make it successful, as well as my background in software development, which mostly focuses on open source. But I haven't really had a chance to talk about it. So I'm really excited to share, you know, what we learned and, you know, the fun that we had and the challenges that we had. And I think that this is a, you know, it doesn't work for everybody, but if there's a company out there that maybe is having some of the same challenges, it would be nice for them to know that they're not alone and that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Fantastic. Just out of curiosity, you have a particular four-letter acronym that you like to say, right?
Yeah, I do. I do. I not only do I like to say it, I have it tattooed on my right forearm.
That's pretty awesome. Okay. So, so what is it?
Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Let's make the fake version of the swear. The kitty version.
Yeah. So this, we'll keep it PG. So the letters are JFDI, which stands for just effing do it. And you can fill in the rest. It's a bit of a personal mantra that a lot of other people have taken on and seem to really enjoy and appreciate and sort of, you know, it's my, it's on my forearm because when I get up in the morning and I'm brushing my teeth or when I'm about to go to bed and brushing my teeth, I see it in the mirror. I have to see it at least twice a day. It's sort of a constant reminder to whatever that thing that you're not doing, but you know you should be doing.
Just
effing do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's some of it's like cathartic relief. Some of it, you know, we talked to all the different things that I work on. I'm not a superhero. I still sleep 8 hours a night. I don't, you know, I work on lots of things because I enjoy working on lots of things. And the reason I'm able to work on lots of things is because I don't dawdle in making decisions and getting things done. So the tattoo works.
Right. Analysis paralysis can really kill any of your, you know, thoughts that might turn into something wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was just talking to somebody earlier today about sort of I have a philosophy that there's always a finite number of bad things that can happen. And you need to sort of become aware of them and do what you can to mitigate them. But the idea that you can prevent bad things from happening is paralyzing in and of itself because you can't.
Right.
So sort of become aware to the finite number of bad things that can happen and do a little bit of work to mitigate them. Once you've got that out of the way, there's now an infinite number of good things that can happen and you work on those. And I spend my days working in the infinite number of good things that can happen.
Much better place to be, huh?
It's so much more fun.
Where can people find out some of your writings and you know, things that you're working on?
Sure. So my personal blog is dangerouslyawesome.com. You know, it's a modest title. also, I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's Alex Knows HTML, like KNOWS.
Mm-hmm.
From the days when I knew HTML. Now, like, I see HTML5 and I'm like, well, I don't know this. But it's not Alex Knows HTML5. It's just Alex Knows HTML.
You're still safe.
Yeah, it should probably Alex Knows XHTML.
XHTML,
yeah,
right.
So I can validate. Anyway, so yeah, Twitter and on my blog are two of the best things. And also, if you're in Philadelphia, because you live here, or if you're visiting Philadelphia for ETE or anything, come by and visit Indie Hall and, you know, meet me and some of my friends here. It's a fun place to get some work done or hang out, grab a cup of coffee, and meet some people that are working on cool stuff that they care about.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much, Alex.
Thank you.